Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
My guest tonight is Brian Childs. He's a veteran small business coach of some 40 years, currently with the Western Australian Small Business Development Corporation. He's based in Perth and joins us on the program this evening. Brian, good evening.
Hi, Philip. How are you?
Not too bad. Just get a little closer to that microphone for us, Brian, can you? And it's been a particularly tough time, hasn't it, across the country? Border closures and lockdowns, rising inflation. Not an ideal time for any business, particularly small business, I imagine.
It's been a time of great uncertainty, and human beings naturally try to avoid uncertainty if they can. And in addition to that, it's been something where we've never been through it before. And everyone was trying to make the rules up as they went along. And I must say, I think we've made a good fist of it.
Yeah, business can, that's true. Is there any, I mean, if, is there any such thing as small business conditions, or is it simply conditions that are good for business are good for all businesses, big and small?
You're right. Small business conditions is like saying the word climate. Everyone's involved, large or small. When interest rates fluctuate up or down, it has an effect upon everyone in business, including small business. The only difference is the number of zeros on the balance sheet.
Yes, exactly. Sometimes when people talk about small business, you get the idea that it's a kind of separate economy, but it's not, is it?
No, small business is the nursery for large business. There is no such thing as a large business created overnight. Every large business is a function of small business. And a metaphor that springs to mind is if you imagine an orchard where we're going to grow trees, that's business, to produce fruit, that's profit, you have to have a nursery. And in a nursery, you're going to have fatalities. There's going to be little plants that we try to grow and they die. And that's a metaphor for small business. It's the nursery for medium-sized and large business.
Yeah, all right. I suppose we should start with some definitions. What defines a small business anyway? I mean, we're all familiar with a newsagent or a cafe. What is the definition of a small business?
The definition of a small business is a service-based business of less than 20 employees, or a manufacturing business of less than 100 employees. Now, that's a very broad definition, as you can probably imagine. And it captures the sole traders, the tradie with the dog and the ute, going right through to the well-established structure with several shareholders and a couple of directors and a managing director and a full team of in-house professionals.
Yeah, we often hear this this phrase of, you know, small business is the engine room of the economy. Although the figures don't really bear this out, do they?
Well, I'll just first of all dwell on the engine room of the economy. Every job is a function of business. Every government bureaucrat is paid from taxes, and all taxes come directly or indirectly from business. There is no other source of tax. And every large business was a medium-sized business. And every medium-sized business started as a small business. So if you want to have a BHP-type business in 100 years' time from today, you should be fostering small business today because one day one will be another BHP. So it is the engine room that drives the economy.
Yes, in that sense. Does it? I was just looking at some ABS figures, which the most recent data, I think, which is from about 2020. Small business employment, looking at small business employment, there were less people employed, it seemed, than a decade ago. What's happened here?
Yes, I saw the same figures. I don't truly understand what's going on there, and I really can't criticise or support the figures. It doesn't make sense to me. But something that has certainly been happening in the last two or three years with the inevitable pressures that COVID has brought about is that many of the small businesses that would have formed and employed people have in fact stayed with simply the foundation person and their life partner. Effectively, the husband and wife, if they're married, or two guys or two girls, or a father and daughter, or a mother and son, who set up and they conduct themselves as if they're a partnership. They might be structured as a company or a trust, but they're not employing people. They're simply starting their business in order to create employment for themselves.
Yes, it seems that small business employment was at a peak in 2007, and since then, actually, employment in small businesses actually declined, something like 6.3%.
Yeah, I saw that.
You say you're puzzled by this and there's not really an obvious explanation?
Well, if we go back to 2007, we had the GFC, the Global Financial Crisis, with all the loss of confidence that brought about. And if you were in business yourself and you found yourself facing uncertainty, you start to skinny down on your costs. And typically the largest cost is employing people. So as people leave you, you don't put new people on because of anxiety and fear.
Yes, it's, it's perennially difficult. I mean, running businesses generally is difficult. Most of them, I think it's fair to say, is that most small businesses fail in the first 5 years, don't they?
Well, that's a figure that's been around for a long time. But one of the problems we face is that how that was measured was business name re-registration.
Right.
For example, your name is Philip. And my name is Brian. Mm-hmm. So we set up a new business called Bryfield. I just made that up.
Yeah.
And in 2 years' time, there's a falling out between you and I. So you just change the name to Philip. And I tootle off. The business continues. But the old name has elapsed and a new name's been created. So one business has failed and one business has been created. No. It was the same business all along. So how these figures are sometimes calculated is of business name re-registrations, not business failures. So people can sell a business and the new business takes over and changes the trading name. Now, that appears to be a business failure. Another one is where people have a business for 2 or 3 years and sell it. Now, that business survives under a new name, but the old name has elapsed. So the appearance is business failure rate. There's no really solid way of measuring it.
So you would, okay, right. No, I get that. And I love the tyranny of statistics. And what's the old cliche about statistics?
Yes,
and the drunk and the lamppost is that you use the figures as support rather than illumination in some instances.
Something like that.
You say there are three critical issues that face small business perennially. It's not just in the current climate.
For the last 41 years.
Yeah. There are three main things, and they are, one, profitability, two, stress management, and three, finding good staff. And these things never change.
Correct.
All
that changes is the emphasis on the day, week, month, or year. And I'll just cast my mind back to the very first consultancy I did 41 years ago. I walked in, sat down, and did an interview with the owners, and they were the three issues.
Yeah.
Today, if you jump in a car with me and we go out to see a new client for the very first time, they were the same three issues. So let's explore them a little bit. Profitability. Most people in business, small business I'm talking about here, are not particularly good at reading their figures or reading their numbers. Mm-hmm. They're sluggish and slow at getting the figures. And when they see the figures, they treat them as accountancy numbers that are not really real or taxation numbers which don't really make sense. And they don't use them as an illumination as to where they've been and where they're going. And history implies the future. And when someone like me comes along and I go through their figures with them, I can immediately see ways of improving the profitability. Now, the profitability is the percentage of net profit thrown off per dollar, such as 10% or 12%. That's profitability.
Right.
So we can immediately look at how we can improve the business by reading the numbers. And commonly what the client will say is, well, how come my accountant's never explained this to me? And, of course, the answer to that is, did you ever ask the accountant? And the answer is, no, I didn't. Why didn't you ask the accountant? Because I didn't know I should ask this question.
Talk to me some more about understanding the figures, though, because there'll be small business people listening who will say, what do you mean here, understanding the figures? Because, you know, I understand what my takings are each week and I understand what my outgoings are each week. Well, what do you mean about understanding the figures?
The very first thing to recognise is that a business is a wealth creation strategy, not an employment strategy.
Uh-huh.
Now, people go into business to create a job for themselves. So as long as they can pay themselves a reasonable wage per week, they seem to be reasonably comfortable.
Right.
They don't understand they should be creating a long-term wealth strategy out of their business, which can be crystallised as a lump sum upon sale. So now we come back to the numbers. And there's three sets of numbers we need to worry about. One is the balance sheet that tells us what we own and what we owe and how much is left over if we sell what we own to pay out what we owe. Now, most people can do that as far as their home is concerned. the same thing applies to a business. So that's the balance sheet. The second tool that we should look at is the profit and loss statement.
Right.
And there's five elements in that. There's the turnover, which is vanity. There's the cost of sales deducted from the turnover to give us gross profit, which is an intermediate calculation.
Mm-hmm.
We then deduct from that our overheads to give us our net profit. Many people in business are impressed by their turnover, but don't bother to look through the numbers to see what their true profitability is.
Right.
And then the third element in the financials is the cash flow projection and the cash flow movements. And you know this, and everyone else knows this. To survive in business, you must have more money coming in than going out. Now, that's viability. Viability means we can survive for another week, month, quarter, year, and pay all our bills with the cash reserves we've got, and we've got money coming in.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of the day, what's on the bottom line of the profit and loss statement? And that should be after deducting a reasonable wage for the owner and if they have a working spouse in the business. And I find that most working owners underpay themselves. They don't pay themselves the rate they would pay a manager if the manager was managing the business. And so when we say to them, look, you should pay yourself the same rate that you'd be paying a manager, the answer is the business can't afford that. Great. So now we need to go back and look at your marketing strategy and look at your pricing and look at your costs to see how we can sweeten the mix up so it can pay you a proper yield for the risk and for the investment of time and capital. And most people in small business don't do this stuff.
Mm-hmm. You say that if you find yourself in small business working for more than 44 hours a week, then there's something wrong.
Correct.
Why? Why do you say that?
The purpose of the business is to fund your lifestyle, not to consume it.
Mm-hmm.
And your lifestyle is made up of two critical elements, money and time. Money to spend during the time you have with your family. So you should be designing the business from day one with the intent from day one of making the business hum profitably, paying you an effective yield for your time and effort and your sacrifice of other opportunities within a 44-hour week. And if it's not doing that, you've got to seriously question why you're doing it. And you'll come across lots of people that tell you proudly they haven't had a holiday for 5 years or 25 years.
They will, I know. Many small business people, I'm sure, would ring me tonight and say, I work 50 or 60 hours in the business
a
week.
It's a badge. It's a badge of honour. I work 70 hours a week. That's 10 hours a day, 7 days a week. Yeah. Never take a day off and haven't had a holiday in 25 years. And I look like I'm 100 years old, but I'm only 48.
Yeah, okay.
And so the question is why? What is the purpose of the business? And the answer, the purpose of the business is solely to fund a lavish current lifestyle and to crystallise a valuable asset that can be sold to fund your retirement. End of story.
We're talking small business. A huge employer in Australia, something like nearly 40% of total employment is derived from small business based on the figures. Although employment in medium-sized businesses has also increased, so has employment in large businesses too. But small business is a very significant employer in Australia. If you've got ideas about starting one or having problems running one, or if you have run one and got out or whatever, questions, here's your opportunity. Who Mark's on the line from Bakers Creek. G'day, Mark.
Oh, g'day, Phil.
Yeah. Hi, Mark.
Just like to say that the small business, you know, for every dollar a small business operator spends, they create $6 in turnover. And it probably repeats on through the rest of the supply chain. He's made some very good points, your guest, about the value of the paying yourself a real wage, etc. But one thing that he hasn't talked about is security of tenure. That's what I rang your producer up about this.
Mm.
Because you can, if you haven't got security of where you're operating your business and people are used to coming to you to deal there, and suddenly, you know, you can't, well, the landlord might decide just, no, you've got to leave, which what happened to me. I lost all my goodwill. You know, the goodwill's very important. I had very good products that cost me bugger all to make. And you know, people were coming from all over to get get my products, but I didn't have security of tenure.
That's a good point to make too. I mean, Brian Mark's right about this, isn't he? That many small businesses have rung me in the past about, you know, the problems of getting set up in big malls, for example. That this is one of the problems. You've got no security of tenure. B, your business is controlled by the mall owner in terms of how much you have to pay them.
Well, we're touching now on commercial leases, which is a favourite topic of mine.
Yeah.
And your caller's comment about the lack of security of tenure. This is an area where small business owners should not hesitate to obtain advice, and that advice would include accounting and legal advice.
Mm-hmm.
And they should do a couple of things before they go off and seeking advice. Number one is obtain a draft copy of the draft lease from the managing agent or the landlord before they attempt any negotiations, and read the lease with care from cover to cover at least three times, and devote 3 hours to each reading. And after those 9 hours of reading, that person will understand that contract is being offered and be able to negotiate from a position of strength. And having talked to their accountant, they will understand what they can afford by way of rent, or given the proposed rent, what the turnover's got to be, yeah, and go back and review the marketing strategy to achieve that. And then have legal advice about whether there's risk to their personal assets in accepting the lease in the form offered. Because going back to my comment about the business being a wealth creation tool, one of the steps you undertake when you create wealth is you then try to protect it from being plundered by other people. And you can avoid that in part by reviewing your lease with care to make sure you're not exposing your personal assets unnecessarily. Legal advice, accounting advice, but there is no substitute for the cup of coffee at the kitchen table, reading the document yourself carefully and slowly from cover to cover with the words I'm about to say ringing in your head. And these are the words: there is no such thing as a standard lease. Everyone's individual.
Okay. All right. Even the ones that the big mall owners like Westfield offer you, for example?
Well, they'll tell you it is their standard lease. It's not the standard lease.
Right.
There is no such thing as a standard lease.
It's just an agreement, and you can always negotiate on its terms, in other words.
Well, it's an agreement designed by their solicitor to protect their interests.
When you say you should pay yourself a proper wage, what is that, Brian? Do you have any rule of thumb about that?
Yes, there's a simple method, and that is you take whatever your take-home pay is, sit down, look at your pay slip, work out what your pre-tax income is, and plus it up by one third. Now, that simply puts you back to what you're currently costing your employer. That is, if Philip employs me, Brian, on $1,000 a week before tax,
mm-hmm,
I'm actually costing Philip about $1,330. Now, from that point on, I've then got to put on an additional margin for risk. So I might decide to pay myself, I'm earning $1,000 a week working for Philip, I need to pay myself $1,500 per week before tax to justify moving across out of working for Philip and working for myself. That's a crude approach we use, and everyone falls about laughing when we say that, saying there's no way we can afford that in the first month or three or five.
Mm.
Not asking to pay it in the first month or three or four or five. We're saying this is the target you've got to design for, and listen to the words, design for. So you define the result you're after, you design for it, and you walk methodically towards it.
Okay, just say that again as to how much you should pay yourself.
In the example I've given you, if I was on a pre-tax wage with you of $1,000 a week,
mm-hmm,
I plus it up by a third and then add on a risk margin depending on the risk of the business. In that example, I came up with a figure of $1,500 per week.
Okay. All right, Brian Childs is with us, a veteran business coach with the WA Small Business Development Corporation for nearly 7 years. We're talking about small business, which is a huge employer in Australia, getting on for 40% of total employment, according to the ABS. Questions about how you run one, if you're running one, the issues, if you're thinking of running one or setting one up. Dan from Coogee's on the line with us. Hi, Dan.
Oh, hi there. Thanks for taking my call.
Pleasure.
My question is, I run a service business in, mm-hmm, the video production industry, in the creative industries, and one of the challenges I see again and again is that it's very difficult to sell a business like this from my experience anyway, I've seen a handful of businesses do it, but not very successfully. Because the reason that you have clients, whether they're clients that are on for 2 or 3 years, is they're not on a permanent contract. You kind of, you know, you might get work from them on an ongoing basis, and they could become 50% of your annual revenue, and it's profitable. But when you go to sell it, it appears that the buyers are always very nervous. Well, how do I know that those clients are going to stay on? And so therefore they say, well, there's no real value in this because there's no guarantee that they're going to stay when you leave.
Because after all, you, the owner, are the value, in other words.
Yeah, and that, I guess, it's very similar for a lot of creative industry businesses, but also for physios and perhaps dentists and, you know, small businesses that are in optometry.
Yeah, it's an interesting point, isn't it, Brian? What do you say to that? And lots of businesses like that. I mean, physio might be the thing. I mean, people go because the physio is great, not because it's at, you know, 3 Smith Street.
Well, before I get into the answer, for every business problem, there's a proven solution.
Right.
Let's address this. Commonly, when someone's buying a business, they would interrogate the client base of the vendor's business, and they would rank the clients into A, Bs and Cs, and they would make an assumption that a certain proportion of the clients are going to fall away at the transaction simply because the client has an emotional connection to the outgoing vendor, mm-hmm. or because the client has been thinking about leaving for a while now, and this is a trigger that causes the client to go. Now, most qualified, competent management accountants are skilled in helping the outgoing vendor to review their client base, to work out how to mix the client base into A, Bs and Cs. A clients are clients that spend well and stay and are consistent and reliable. B clients spend a bit, are pretty good. And C clients are tire kickers who spend a little bit of money and cause a lot of grief. The accountant can help the vendor to reallocate their CRM, their client relationship management software, into that hierarchy. And the incoming buyer will buy on the A's and the B's, not the C's.
Right.
And that's the cold, hard of reality.
Right.
And the incoming buyer will also want the outgoing vendor to sign off on an agreement that they won't plunder the client base by approaching people after they sell.
Yeah. But does Dan have a point here that in some instances, such as the one he's running, that you know, the business might only have a real... Well, the real value of the business is in the fact that you run it, and that if you're trying to sell it, it may not be worth anything like what the current turnover income is if you leave.
That's a common reality, and the solution lies in Dan's case, progressively weaning the business off his personal attention and progressively transitioning the clients to paid staff,
right,
and having contracts with those paid staff, and having those paid staff on the appropriate award, so that the incoming buyer would see that they're buying a business that is an engine that produces cash that doesn't rely upon the personal exertion of Dan.
Mm. What do you say about that, Dan?
That's really interesting. You know, the ABCs, I definitely know who my A's and B's are, and it's pretty easy to see who the C's are.
Yeah.
And I guess it is. It's that weaning off. How do you, you know, I guess I need to focus on how do I get my clients to feel comfortable that they can rely on my staff rather than me being at every shoot, you know, because if I can do that and bring other people in to do the jobs that I do that are, you know, on either ongoing contracts or, I guess, in that situation, you know, have enough loyalty to the fact that they know if they're subcontractors, which a lot of people in our industry are, especially the creatives, that they have loyalty to the fact that they know the business is going to support them in their creativity and they'll continue to have ongoing income. So it does make sense, and appreciate the guidance and advice.
Thanks, Dan. Yeah, I mean, Dan does raise some important points there, doesn't he, Brian? So you're saying essentially one of the key things you ought to be doing as a small business owner from early on is seeking to transfer the day-to-day expertise onto staff.
Correct. Set up procedures. You can go out and acquire the clients. I'm very good at that. But then the client becomes welded to you and they attach very tightly. However, the plan should be that once you've acquired the client, you progressively bring the preferred person forward and transition the client to that person. Because sooner or later, you're going to get hit by the metaphorical bus.
Mm.
You're going to find yourself in hospital with a mild heart attack or some such thing that prevents you from servicing the client. And you're going to create long-term business value by making the client not depend upon you, but depend upon paid staff.
Yeah. What about the other? I mean, look, and I know this doesn't apply to all small businesses and probably not to, to hospital. Well, it might apply to some hospitality businesses as well. But I've seen myself with colleagues and friends sometimes with businesses that seem to fall into the trap of having not too many clients but too few, and often particularly consulting or creative businesses that end up basically having one or two or even three big clients that provide most of the income. The danger there, of course, is that if they leave for some reason – then that's the end of you. I mean, do you need to be careful about this? Do you need to sometimes knock back work, even if it's from good clients, because you want to try and have as diverse a base of clients as you can?
Well, it comes back to first defining your objectives at the outset.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to have an interesting, juicy job with two or three clients that all love you to death and you love them
yeah.
and you spend all day, every day with them, that's what you ask for, that's what you get.
Hmm.
But you've got to stop and think before you enter small business. What is my purpose in starting a business? And I repeat, your purpose in starting a business is a wealth creation strategy to throw off income that will fund a lavish lifestyle now and a valuable asset that can be crystallised for sale later to fund your retirement. And with that in mind, you then design your conduct around that, not simply getting yourself a job.
Hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. Because I've heard it said in the past, when you see a lot of these franchise businesses advertised, that essentially what people are doing in those is just buying themselves a job. That's all it is. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Yes, I see many franchises where they've bought themselves an underpaid job
yeah.
at great risk, welded into a relationship with someone they end up not liking, and stuck there for several years in a lease with all the difficulties that go with being in a business that's not particularly profitable, that causes them a lot of stress and strain, and they wish they could get out of it. So when it comes to franchises, it's a very simple technique. When you're thinking about buying into a franchise, get the franchisor to give you a list of all the people from the franchise in other states, not in the one that you're in, and ring people in other states, not the one you're in, and talk to them about the fact you're thinking about buying a franchise in your home state, not where they are.
Yeah.
And then have a frank and fearless conversation with them about what it's like being a franchisee, because now they're not going to try and sell you on their franchise that they're trying to get rid of.
Mm. Yeah, good advice. 1-300-800-222. Colin from Lane Cove. G'day, Col.
Oh, g'day. I think the main problem with small businesses is they're so self-centred about themselves and no focus on the customer experience. Bad service seems to be the norm nowadays because businesses are so caught up in trying to keep themselves in the financial situation they're trying to be in. Like a good example in the metaphor is perhaps the speakerphone. It's quite easy to use a speakerphone because it suits you, but the customer at the other end is not getting a great communication experience. But like running a radio program, I suppose your listeners should be the most important thing, and you should have your guests speaking on a proper phone so we can get clear communication.
Mm. Yes, all right. I mean, customer service is at the heart of everything, I guess, Brian, isn't it?
It's the only thing. It's not the heart of it. It's the entire situation.
Mm.
The customer is the sole source of income to the business. It's the sole source of wealth to the owner.
Mm.
It's the sole means by which they'll pay their staff and buy their own groceries. And the owner should be fixated on their customer service.
Mm. All right, 1-300-800-222. Paul is from Townsville. G'day, Paul. Hi, Paul.
Good evening.
Hi.
Hey. Good evening. How are you going?
Not bad.
Hey, listen, I know you're talking about small business,
mm-hmm.
but if we add SMEs, as in small to medium businesses,
mm-hmm.
which is still essentially, you know, individually owned, at some point, we're talking about 70-80% employment in that sector.
Mm.
Now, when your guest And I must admit, I'm sorry, I forgot your name, bloke.
Brian's the guest. What's your question here, Paul?
Oh, Brian. Brian, what do you think, and I know you've spoken about work-life balance and wages, et cetera, but from my experience, we end up working for our staff in SMEs.
Mm. Yeah.
And it's really hard because you're trying to, you know, keep the business afloat. And Brian, you're saying, well, you know, you need to cut back working hours or do this or do that. But how do you really make that work?
It's a good question, isn't it, Brian? Because I would think if there's a common complaint for small businesses, it would be this, that, you know, they're paying themselves less than the staff and that they just can't seem to get their head above water.
Well, it goes back to one of the three issues that we encounter every time we see a new client, and that's profitability.
Yeah.
Because if we find ways of improving Paul's profitability, that will throw off extra cash and he can then use that to hire in some management talent that can help him to release him to not spend his whole life working hard to pay other people.
Yeah, because if you're just paying other people, you would say you failed the basic test, the number one first principle of a small business, which is that it's not providing you with a proper income. So therefore, it's not providing you with a proper income. It's not a successful small business, you would say.
Exactly. It comes back to what you've decided at the outset you want to design for.
Yeah.
If you want to design for a 70-hour week without holidays to be the lowest paid person and to create income and wealth for other people, then you've succeeded, if that's what you want to do.
Yeah. Ramon. No, hang on. We've lost Ramon there. James in Perth. Hi, James.
Hello there. How you going, Phil?
Yeah, not bad.
And the gentleman in the background. Listen, I've got a very strong view on what we're talking about. I'm an extrovert, as you probably tell in my voice. If I ran a business, I'm an accountant, and I've seen businesses. But at the end of the day, I don't care about this anything else but customers. If a guy buys a business off me, he has to have the same personality and vibrance to be able to get the people to come in to talk about the footy and all that kind of thing to attract that. If you get a guy that buys a business and thinks this is what it's done and this is what the turnover is, and he's a quiet guy and he hasn't got the skills to attract people and get word of mouth to come in the shop, well, he's going to hope. He'll lose money on the business.
You're right.
Yep.
You're dead right.
Absolutely. I just think it's so simple. It's as simple as that. I could build up a business. I wish I had the, you know, what's to buy one, but you know, something like a news agency. I just love people, you know, and the people that I see that buy businesses that just haven't got the people skills, they end up losing money. It's not about anything but the customer experience. That's all I've got to say. Thank you very much, guys.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Thanks, James. 1-300-800-222 What do you think, Brian? You often hear, well, you often see people who are good at one thing, thinking I could make a business out of this. Now, you know, that might be people who are good at cooking, thinking I'll start a cafe or a restaurant. And likewise, what do you think? How should you rate your own skills in this regard? What do you think? I mean, is it necessarily the fact that you have to be good at what your business is offering to make it work?
Well, your question is, if I have a technical skill,
yeah,
and I'm particularly gifted at my technical skill, does it automatically follow that I'll be successful in business? And unfortunately, the answer is no.
Yeah.
The technical skill is a component, but it's not the singular component. And there's a range of hats you have to wear in business. We've already mentioned the finance hat. There's the marketing hat. There's the HR hat, where you have to be an amateur psychologist to deal with your staff. And you also have to deal with your suppliers and you have to deal with your customers. So beyond the simple technical, I can do a good job with this particular skill I have, you then have to explore whether you have the capacity to acquire these other skills as you go along. And one way of discovering those other skills that are going to be required would be to do some workshops or to read a book or to go and interview someone who runs a business. And the best way to find out about the world of business is to ring someone who's in the same kind of business that you want to go into, with, say, cake making as an example,
yeah.
Ring someone in the same business in another city and say, I'm calling you from insert your place, and you're in that place, insert their place, and I'm not going to be a competitor, and I'm thinking about setting up in the same kind of business as you, can we have a frank conversation? Now, most people think that when someone makes that kind of call, the person won't discuss anything with them. My experience is you can't shut them up, because for the first time in their life, they're talking to someone that's actually interested in what their world is like.
Yeah.
And they'll expose the caller to their world, and they'll tell you what it's like. And they'll tell you not to go ahead and do it. But if you are determined to go ahead and do it, make sure you do this and make sure you do that and do this and do that and get a good accountant, et cetera.
Mm. Getting a good accountant, you've returned to this quite a few times. What does that mean in terms of getting a good accountant? I mean, I'm sure all accountants, when you ring them up, say, I'm a good accountant. What does it mean?
Clear my bias now at this point. I love the accounting profession. They are declared my bias.
Right.
What people need in an accountant is a management accountant. Now, there's many different types of accountants, but we need a management accountant when we're starting a business. Now, the next question is, can they do my tax? Yes, all accountants can do your tax, but we want someone who's a management accountant who will help us dissect the financial dynamics of the business and understand them, understand the interplay between the dynamics and understand where that's taking us and understand cause-effect. If I do this, it has that effect. And I'll give you a simple example to illustrate. One of the first things I say to clients when they want to increase their profitability, I ask a question. How long has it been since you've raised your prices, is the question Brian asks.
Hmm.
And the most common answer is, we've been in business for 7 years. I didn't ask you how long you've been in business. I asked you how long it's been since, you haven't raised your prices since you started, have you? No. Good. Now we're going to raise your prices. But we'll lose customers. No, you won't. Yes, I will. No, you won't. Yes, I will. Listen to me. I'm the advisor. We're going to raise your prices tomorrow.
Yeah.
And that will translate to the bottom line. And that is management accounting. We're looking at the financial dynamics and looking at, if we just put the screwdriver in this slot here and give a little twist here and shave that one back there, look at the impact on the bottom line. That's management accounting. And that's what, when we say you need a good accountant, you need a management accountant. Next question. How do you find a good accountant? Answer, ask successful people in business who they recommend as an accountant. Guess who they're going to recommend? Their accountant.
Their own accountant, yeah.
Correct. And they're successful for two reasons. One, they've had good advice. Two, they executed the advice. Long pause.
Okay. We're talking with Brian Childs. He's with the WA Small Business Development Corporation. We're talking about advice for small businesses. And if you're in small business and you'd like to ask some advice or maybe offer some wisdom too, 1300 800 222, text 0467 922702. I love this idea of ringing someone in another state about the business that they're running. And in your experience, as you say, you'll get some terrific advice from them.
I've done it many times as a business advisor in previous lives.
Hmm.
I've been handed clients, and what happens is this. So I'll just dwell on this for a moment. The accountant does what they can to help the client, and then when they run out of ideas, they hand them over to me.
Yeah.
And let's imagine the client is an electrical engineer and I know nothing about electrical engineering. I'll spend 4 or 5 days ringing electrical engineers in other states, asking them about electrical engineering and what it's like and how it works before I go and see the client. And when I turn up to the client, I know the questions and I know the answers. And the client will often look at me and say, are you an electrical engineer because you know a lot about this game? No, I'm not. I'm a business advisor. My job is to find out about your game before I come and see you. And the easiest technique of the lot is to ring established businesses in other states who know you're not competing and not going to be a threat.
Mm. Interesting. Andrew, near Canberra. Hello, Andrew.
Good morning, Phil and Brian. Good evening.
No, evening, Brian. Evening still, but that's okay.
Evening. I was just going to say that Brian was saying there about putting a 50% over what you'd be making on wages. So if you're making $100,000 on wages, you need to be making $150,000 self-employed. I think you've got to double it. My experience has been that by the time you pay your workers' comp, superannuation, leave bonuses, holidays, all those things that go with it, your rule of thumb is to double it. That's been my
for
experience.
What you should pay yourself, you mean?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so if you can make 100 somewhere, construction company or something, if you're self-employed, you need to be making 200 to be making the same sort of money.
Yeah, yeah.
But that business about the accountant, I couldn't agree more with that. The accountant is tantamount to success.
Yeah. Thank you, Andrew. Yeah, Brian, you'd agree with that. I suspect there are a lot of, I mean, maybe even most small business owners listening tonight would say, well, that's not what I'm paying myself. Nowhere near it.
Wake up call now.
Yeah.
If you're now not paying yourself that much, grab a piece of paper, sit down and write on the piece of paper how much you think you should be paid.
Yeah.
And then trot off to your accountant tomorrow and sit down and say, how do we get there from here?
Yeah. What are you? You're big on a business plan.
Yes.
What's that mean? I mean, if I'm opening a cafe that sells mainly coffee, what's a business plan?
Well, the business plan contains a number of key elements that interplay with each other and ultimately express themselves as a set of financial projections. Mm-hmm. So let's just explore that for a moment. What's your HR strategy? What kind of people will you hire? How will you find them? What kind of conditions will they have to work under? What's the appropriate award? What is the fully sunk cost of hiring those people?
Uh-huh.
And what training will you put them through? So there's your HR element, if you like, in your business plan. Then there's your operations plan. How will you go about getting your logistics organized? Where will you be sourcing your materials from? How will you store them? How will you process them into a finished product? Mm-hmm. That's your logistics. I'm being very quick.
Yeah.
Then there's your location. What kind of location will be the ideal location? What is it likely to cost? What additional costs will you have to incur? What will be the fit-out costs? What will it cost you to get in? What will it cost you to stay? What will it cost you to come out? Then there's your marketing plan. How are you going to get people to know about you, come to you, and pay you the kind of money you should be paid to provide the services or product you wish to provide?
Mm-hmm.
Now, all those elements, and there's more, then are rolled up into a set of financial projections. And the two most critical financial projections, they're built off your sales forecast, which I haven't really explained, is your profit and loss statement and your cash flow projection. And your cash flow and your profit and loss will never reconcile because there's timing differences. But if you do this, here's what you'll find. You've tested with pretend money in pretend time with pretend customers as to whether you'd like to make a pretend profit. If it all looks good on paper, you go ahead and commit. Now, the value in the business plan is not the plan itself. The value in the business plan is the thinking that went into the plan you wrote.
Right.
You'll find that the moment you make contact with the enemy, that's the economy, your plan will be out of date. Doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Because your thinking has already been developed before you make contact with the enemy. And then you can be agile and effective. You can make decisions in real time. And then as you're tracking along, you've got a mental picture of how this should be happening and you can start comparing off your bank statement and off your financials, how you're travelling against what the original picture was.
Mm.
So there is no substitute for planning. None. Zero. Zip.
I guess, I imagine a lot of people don't do that very well. Rooster. Hello, Rooster.
Hello, how are you?
Not too bad. You're in Fremantle. Yep, you're in food and beverage.
I am, and I'm very interested in this conversation because your man speaks the truth in so many ways.
Mm.
My question is to the learned guest, what is the margin that I need to put on a raw product to make a profit over time? Understanding the fact that there's projection, there's rent, there's the marketability of the business and so on and so forth. Is there an actual multiplier that I should apply? Because it seems in my business, the multiplier seems to sit around 4 to 5. That makes, at the end result, a somewhat expensive good for the end consumer.
Mm. Yeah, okay. Is there a rule of thumb here, Brian?
Look, it's a how long is a piece of string question, but I'll try and answer it.
Mm.
In general terms, 3 times raw materials. Now, in your case, you've already got the 4 or 5. So the question now is how do we package it and how do we present it and how do we market it to the paying customer so they're prepared to pay the 4 or 5 time multiplier? And I'll give you an example with regard to handbags. My wife buys handbags.
Right.
Yeah, she can go and buy one handbag for $250 or $400 and looks the same to me as a handbag in the shop for $2,000 or $4,000.
Yeah.
I don't appreciate the differences. She does. But someone somewhere has managed to convince people to pay $4,000 for a handbag. It's got the same number of handles and hinges and pockets in it as the one for $400. Back to our caller, Brewster. What you've got to look at is how you can market or present your product as a Mercedes-Benz or a BMW version of what it is you're selling rather than the Holden Commodore version.
Very good, because that's my answer. I mean, I'm looking at a luxe market, and that's what I've deduced over working in small business over years in beverage, in food, in clothes, selling secondary goods such as wood, meat, and so on. That seems to be the answer, the luxe. What is your comment on the luxe market? Is it a market that's sustainable?
Short answer is yes, if that's what you design for. Sam Walton in America designed for the high volume, very, very low margin, and designed for that. Rolls-Royce designed for the very small volume, high margin. You've got to decide what you're designing for and then pursue it. There is no one singular outstanding sweet spot. There's sweet spots everywhere that you have to design for.
Okay. Good on you, Rooster. Thank you. I think I hope that was helpful. 1-300-800-222 is the number. Have we got time for one more? Barbara is on the line. Hi, Barb. Barb's in Hobart.
Hi, how are you?
Barb's in Hobart, where it's always sunny and fine.
That it was. A beautiful day today. My question is, I'm in year number 10 of my small business in the health industry, and I seem to be in a continual state of growth. I've expanded my team. I've now put in middle management, and the opportunities just keep rolling, but I never get that breathing space to get up the really big positive cash flow to make that next step up.
So how do you scale it, in other words? Brian, what do you advise here?
Well, the first thing Barbara's got to do is she's got to review her time management practices, because she's working very hard and she's on the constant treadmill, and the harder she runs on the treadmill, the more the treadmill inclines up. And she needs to take time out to think, T-H-I-N-K. There's no substitute for it. But for Barbara to take time out to think, she's got to manage her time to give her some time to stop and think. And that thinking time should be around, first of all, defining the result or outcome she wants, defining her goal, the end purpose, the end point. And then sitting down very clearly and clarifying that in writing, specifying it. Writing it for a five-year-old child to understand on the other side of the planet, if they never met you, they could tell you what it means. And then trotting off to the accountant and sitting down and working out, if this is where we want to get to, how do we get there from here? And you start walking backwards.
Walking backwards from there, yeah. All right, look, sadly, time has beaten us. There's been some very, very hard-headed advice, Brian. I really appreciate your time and thank you.
My pleasure, Philip. It's been a joy talking to you, and I'll be happy to talk to you again.
Brian Childs is from the WA Small Business Development Corporation, a veteran business coach. I hope you found that useful. I think there's some hard lessons there. All right, we've got the latest ABC News now.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.